Welcome, I'm Rose Aguilar, and this is Your Call. In 1982, today's guest, Norman Solomon, wrote his first book, co-authored with Harvey Wasserman, called Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation. In 1990, he wrote the book Unreliable Sources, A Guide to Detecting Bias in News Media. He went on to write several other important books, including False Hope, The Politics of Illusion in the Clinton Era in 1994, and War Made Easy, How Presidents and Pundits Keep Spinning Us to Death. His 13th book, out recently, is called War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. He argues that more than 20 years ago, 9/11 and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan set into motion a hugely consequential shift in America's foreign policy, a perpetual state of war that is almost entirely invisible to the American public. He writes, quote, "What happens at the other end of American weaponry has remained almost entirely a mystery, with only occasional brief glimpses before the curtain falls back into its usual place. Meanwhile, the results at home fester in shadows. Overall, America has been conditioned to accept ongoing wars without ever really knowing what they're doing to people we will never see." End quote. Norman Solomon is a veteran media critic, columnist, and activist. He's co-founder of Roots Action, an organization dedicated to galvanizing people who are committed to economic fairness, equal rights for all, civil liberties, and environmental protection, and defunding endless wars. He's also executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, an organization that increases the reach and capacity of progressive and grassroots organizations. And he's the author of many, many books. And we're very happy to have Norman Solomon on today's show. Hi, Norman. Thanks so much for joining us. And congratulations on yet another important book.
Thanks a lot, Rose.
You know, Norman, I was just reading your long bio and just looking at your incredible body of work. You have seen so much. I just wonder, given that you wrote your first book back in 1982, what keeps you going? What keeps you doing this work?
Well, that's a sort of internally inscrutable question to answer somehow, because for me, one aspect of life has led to another. I think it was formative to me that I spent a year and a half as a child in Calcutta, India, and it was very far from the suburbs of Wilmington, Delaware, where I was right before that. So it was sort of a jolt out of the American image of what life was for everybody when I saw it was very different for some. And then I grew up around Washington, D.C. during the escalation of the Vietnam War, and that gradually was an eye-opener for me in many ways.
But you haven't given up. I mean, you've covered so many invasions. You have run for office. You worked on Bernie Sanders' campaign. And I have to say, Norman, we're ending, you know, we're about to end the year now. And a lot of people write in and say, sometimes the show is so intense. Can you focus on maybe lighter topics? It's just too much. Or I hear that people are not in tune as much as they used to be. They're not listening to the news as much because it is so intense. So what keeps you doing this work? How do you maintain what it takes to do this work?
Well, I can certainly understand those feelings that people have because the news is so downbeat, to put it mildly, and increasingly so in this last year. So to me, it's a matter of trying to find an equilibrium, which I think for all of us to some degree is elusive and not totally possible, because we live in a very difficult world in our communities and in the world. If we have our antennas out and we try to understand what's happening to others in other situations, I think of it as sort of an ecology of our own lives that I try to achieve and that others of us also try to achieve, a balance, so that we need art, we need nature, we need culture, personal relationships, and there's a wider world too. Mm-hmm. And connecting with other human beings, whether we know them personally, or we can connect with them some other ways in this country and in the world, that's sustaining. And I can understand many people say, it's too depressing to see the news. It's too upsetting to really think about it. But I feel for so many people, certainly for myself, that it's actually more depressing to be passive, mm-hmm. to consume history, so to speak, like Wonder Bread coming off the shelf. When we engage, when we connect with other people, that's empowering. It's, if you will, potentially spiritually enriching, so that we feel like we're alive and we can, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, experience love not only as an abstraction, but with power, with other people to make life better for humanity.
Well, and I have to say, I have so much respect for your work, because the theme that really came out of your latest book, but so much of your work, is that we need to pay more attention to the people who are on the receiving end of U.S. weapons and bombs. In fact, in your acknowledgments, you write, this is the first sentence of your acknowledgments in your new book, "Memories of people I met in Iraq and Afghanistan challenged me to avoid abstraction while writing this book. What I learned from them was beyond measure."
There's so many obstacles to getting beyond our very human activity and predilection to be in a frame of mind of out of sight, out of mind. We don't see people who we don't see. Our experience with the world is largely through news media, TV, radio, newspapers, what's on screen, popular entertainment, what kind of education we got or didn't get. And so it's so easy for people to seem like an abstraction. And that really diminishes our own humanity, although it might not seem that way.
You start your new book by writing about Afghanistan with a focus of the media coverage of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001. And it's almost head-spinning, Norman, to go back and read what Donald Rumsfeld said or what journalists at that time said. Here are just a couple of examples. And you can tell us why you think this is really important to revisit. As the United States exploded bombs in Afghanistan during the autumn of 2001, Defense Secretary Donald Rumsfeld's daily briefings catapulted him into a stratosphere of national adulation. The Washington Post's media reporter wrote that, quote, "Everyone is genuflecting before the Pentagon powerhouse, who is America's new rock star." During an interview that winter, Tim Russert, the host of NBC's Meet the Press, told Donald Rumsfeld, 69 years old and you're America's stud. The televised briefings that brought such adoration included masterful claims of notable decency. Rumsfeld said, quote, "The weapons that are being used today have a degree of precision that no one ever dreamt of." Norman, why do you think it's important to revisit all of this? Why did you start your book focused on media coverage of the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan in 2001?
It's stunning in retrospect to be outside of the frenzy of the time, to see how the kind of social and political and media hysteria had such effects. When we look back at the last 22 years of the so-called war on terror, the facts, the human realities are so shielded from us, who most of us pay the taxes that have helped finance the wars. We, in our names, with our tax dollars, are part of this ongoing warfare. And we rarely hear even the numbers, let alone know the names of any or see the faces of any of the people who've been killed, courtesy of the U.S. government. When the Cost of War Project at Brown University did a meticulous study to try to tote up the numbers, found that the post-9/11 wars waged by the United States have taken close to 1 million lives directly, 950,000 of them, and more than 400,000 of those people were civilians. So when you think about it in terms of numbers, for each innocent soul that was extinguished on 9/11, the United States government directly took the lives of 100 equally innocent souls in the next 2 decades. And then when you look at the indirect deaths, according to Brown University, 4.5 million people, it's even more staggering. The ratio is 1 to 1,000 deaths in comparison to what happened on that terrible day, September 11th, 2001. A lot of these dynamics, I think, Rose, are very much still in play as we speak. And it's a difference in style, in context. But as you mentioned, Donald Rumsfeld had become such a media star, so much adulation. And I quote in the book, one of the things he said as the deaths mounted up in Afghanistan in those first months, Rumsfeld said, and I'm quoting here, "We did not start this war, so understand responsibility for every single casualty in this war, whether they're innocent Afghans or innocent Americans, rests at the feet of Al-Qaeda and the Taliban," unquote. Well, we've heard that in the last few weeks. We've heard that from the top leaders of the Israeli government, Benjamin Netanyahu, saying, "Oh, well, it's unfortunate all of these Palestinian civilians who have died, but every single one of those deaths is the responsibility of Hamas." Top U.S. government officials have said echoes of that as well. Well, this is a, so to speak, a blank check for killing civilians on a massive scale. There are always rationales for doing it. There is always massive suffering endured by people who had no responsibility whatsoever for the preceding crimes.
Well, we're going to talk about that later in the show, but since you brought this up, I mean, the death toll is just staggering. According to officials, over 15,000 Palestinians have been killed. The New York Times reported that people in Gaza are being killed at an historic pace. Even a conservative assessment of the reported Gaza casualty figures show that the rate of death during Israel's assault has few precedents in this century.
The United Nations has said that in the past many weeks, children in Gaza have been killed at a rate of 10 of them per hour. Mm. It's stunning. And questions come up, I think, consciously or not. How could this happen? And how could, in the country providing the weaponry, providing the subsidy for those killings, which is the United States of America, how could our leaders of our government and much of our media take it as something that is necessary and, frankly, not such a big deal? Mm. When we've had a resolution in Congress for a ceasefire on the table since early last month, and several weeks into that resolution being available for co-sponsorship, with well over 5,000 civilians dead, close to 10,000, there was a grand total of 18 members of the House of Representatives willing to put their names on that bill as co-sponsors, simply calling for a ceasefire. That's 4% of the U.S. House of Representatives. In the entire state of California, we had one member of the House willing to co-sponsor, Barbara Lee. So as we sometimes, with justification, feel good about the progressive members of the House from the Bay Area and from the state of California, we might wonder why only one of them was willing to co-sponsor a ceasefire resolution while 10 children per hour were being massacred courtesy of U.S. taxpayers. And that really raises, I think, some fundamental questions about the warfare state that we live in and what kind of society prevails in the United States.
I just want to repeat this, Norman, because things are moving so fast and it's easy to forget what's happening, or you hear a number here and there, but it's hard to make sense of it. So what you just cited comes from the World Health Organization. I'm reading right now from Reuters, November 10th. A child is killed on average every 10 minutes in the Gaza Strip. The UN said nowhere and no one is safe. WHO Director Tedros Ghebreyesus said half of Gaza's 36 hospitals, two-thirds of its primary healthcare centers, were not functioning, and those that were operating were way beyond their capacity, describing the healthcare system as being on its knees. To think that a child is killed every 10 minutes? I mean, again, 2.3 million people, half of the population is under the age of 18.
This is something that unfortunately is a pattern in U.S. politics and to a large extent, mass media, with the fortunate exception of independent programs and media outlets. And it's one that I sketch out in the book. I'd give another example. There was a notorious interview that then U.S. Ambassador to the United Nations gave with Leslie Stahl on 60 Minutes in 1996 when Albright was asked about reports that 500,000 children had died in Iraq during the previous years due to ongoing U.S.-led sanctions. And notoriously, Albright replied, "That's difficult, but, quote, we think it's worth it." A few months after that, Albright was nominated to become Secretary of State, and she was approved with ratification in the U.S. Senate by a vote of 99-0. Now, if Albright had said that extinguishing the life of one of the senator's children, quote, we think it's worth it, would they have voted for ratification? If there were children of the members of the U.S. House of Representatives who had been killed by the bombardment of Gaza, would we have had a refusal of 96% of the House of Representatives to sign on to a ceasefire resolution? So there's something very human, very political, and very disturbing about these sort of dynamics, which have played out again and again from the Vietnam War, where we had General Westmoreland claiming infamously in the documentary Hearts and Minds that Vietnamese people don't have a high regard for human life. This is some sort of projection of a system of, you might call it, systemic extinguishing of human life. Some might even call it mass murder. It's a rationale from a society that projects inward and outward. Somehow we disregard the human lives of people who are Asian, who are African, who are in the Middle East, who speak a different language, who have a different culture and religion, whose skin color is very different. And somehow we project onto them that they don't regard human lives.
Today, we're spending the hour with Norman Solomon, who's out with his 13th book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. He writes that the U.S. has been conditioned to accept ongoing wars without ever really knowing what they're doing to people we will never see. What are your thoughts on this? If you have any comments or questions for Norman Solomon about U.S. foreign policy, about his main argument that more than 20 years ago, 9/11 and the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan set into motion a perpetual state of war that's almost entirely invisible to the U.S. public. The media, of course, play a major, major role in all of this. We'd love to hear from you. 866-798-8255. 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Norman, going back to your decision to start your book writing about the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, the media coverage of that, and then what we heard from people like Donald Rumsfeld, and how the media really did not push back at all. What are your thoughts about what responsibility means at this point? So the U.S., quote, leaves Afghanistan, and then what? I mean, to think that Afghanistan is barely in the news unless you really look for it. So here's an article from the PBS NewsHour in September. The UN World Food Program announced a lack of funding is forcing it to stop feeding some of the most vulnerable people in Afghanistan. The organization is scaling back just as hunger is rising to record levels, with 15 million Afghans, more than a third of the country, struggling to find their next meal. Here's another story from Radio Free Europe. Just today, actually, Afghan women's rights activists are demanding the International Criminal Court prosecute Afghanistan's Taliban rulers for systemic violations of human rights. I mean, women say that they have just been disappeared in Afghanistan. And yet, as you say, the most powerful country with the largest military in the world spent billions of dollars invading and occupying Afghanistan. So what does it mean to take responsibility after a 20-year occupation and invasion happens, given that people are now going hungry in Afghanistan and women have no rights?
Well, there's talk about responsibility and accountability, but it's not what the rhetoric says, it's what the actions actually show. You're reminding me, Rose, of when I visited Kabul in 2009 and went to the outskirts of the city, the nation's capital there, and met a little girl named Guljuma. She was 7 years old. Like many others in the internal refugee camp, she had woken up one day to find walls falling on her because the U.S. was dropping bombs on the region. And so she lost one arm, and her family was there in a camp where they were scrounging for food. You could barely call it a camp. It was ditches and canvas tarp and so forth. And they were getting no aid because they were internal refugees. Even the Afghan government was not helping them. The U.S. government was not helping them. And it made me think about how the United States government had the money to bomb her, but not to feed her afterwards. Mm. And I think that's an example and a very disturbing metaphor for what you're referring to. After the U.S. pulled all troops out of Afghanistan a little more than 2 years ago, many human rights organizations and NGOs warned of the impending famine. Malnutrition was, as it still is, rife in Afghanistan. And President Biden basically locked up $7 billion with a B dollars worth of central bank money that had belonged to the previous Afghan government, the Karzai government then, supported by the U.S., and basically deprived the capacity of the new Afghan government to be able to sustain the economy in more of a decent level. A lot of people starved. A lot of people went into severe malnutrition as a result. And it really does go to the question of, does the rationale for war have much to do with the actual reasons for war? Because along with going after Al-Qaeda, which was basically routed very soon after the attack on Afghanistan, the other rationale was, we're there to help the Afghan people. And yet we had money to bomb them on the whole, but we didn't have money to help prevent famine. And when finally the White House came through with some money, it averaged out to about $8 a person to feed people. The Taliban has been horrible on women's rights. At the same time, Anand Gopal, who covered Afghanistan in the provinces and wrote ultimately for the, until that time, basically pro-war New Yorker magazine, when the U.S. finally pulled out, that the women of Afghanistan in the provinces, which in Afghanistan is 70% of the population, the rural area, they were terrorized for 2 decades by U.S. bombing, especially in Helmand province in the south. So when you decode all this, and while I certainly believe the Republican Party is fascistic and the Democratic Party is the only way to prevent the Republicans from gaining total federal power, when it gets to foreign policy, we have a bipartisan approach, which we've seen again and again in the so-called war on terror, that we're seeing now in terms of the Middle East, and we're seeing in terms of overall deployment of U.S. troops and maintenance of 750 U.S. bases overseas, that is callous, that is calculating, that is willing to sacrifice untold numbers of human beings for geopolitical positioning, military leverage, and to secure really the power of the U.S. to get favorable trade deals and extract minerals and other natural resources from various continents. In fact, the U.S. is now training virtually every military on the continent of Africa. This is at a time when supposedly we're not at war. You know, President Biden, right after the withdrawal from Afghanistan, told the United Nations General Assembly that the U.S. was no longer at war. I mean, not to put too fine a point on it, but that was a lie. The Brown University Costs of War Project documented that same month the U.S. was engaged in war in 85 different countries in various ways, training troops, special ops, drone strikes, bombing, all sorts of activities virtually hidden from the U.S. public. And, you know, Rose, I just sort of sum up that it is so hard to understand human beings in terms of numbers, but the numbers are important and we virtually never hear them. When we have 4.5 million people who are not on this earth now because of a U.S. war that we were told was against terrorism, then we really need to put it mildly, reevaluate the premise of U.S. foreign policy.
We're going to take a quick break. Today we are spending the hour with Norman Solomon, who is out with a new book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Norman Solomon is a veteran media critic, columnist, and activist. He's co-founder of RootsAction.org, an organization dedicated to galvanizing people who are committed to economic fairness, civil liberties, environmental protection, equal rights, and defunding endless wars. He's also executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy, an organization that increases the reach and capacity of progressive and grassroots organizations to address public policy by getting them and their ideas into the mainstream media. This is Your Call. We'll be back after this. This is Your Call. I'm Rose Aguilar. Today, we're speaking with veteran media critic, columnist, and activist Norman Solomon, who's out with his 13th book, War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. He writes that America has been conditioned to accept ongoing wars without ever really knowing what they're doing to the people we will never see. If you'd like to join the conversation, we'd love to hear from you. The toll-free number is 866-798-8255. You can also email your call at kalw.org. Just quickly before we go to calls, I just want to mention an article that we found from The Diplomat on November 2nd called A New Generation of Women and Girls Defying Gender Apartheid in Afghanistan. And I think this is so important because we know what's happening to girls there. They have no rights. They cannot go to school. And yet girls and women are trying to teach online, although that cannot replace a regular education. The Diplomat reports that underground girls' schools have emerged throughout the whole country in defiance of the education ban. Private schools are keeping their doors open, and then there's informal classes in the homes of teachers and underground book clubs where girls are gathering to read and promote discussion. I think this is so important, Norman, and it also just gets to the points in your book that we need to see people. They're not just, you know, I mean, the images, look at the images of Palestinians in the media. I mean, people have been talking about that, you know, women and men screaming. I mean, it's just, we've been talking about this for years, but it just doesn't seem to really change as much as it needs to.
There's so much in our culture, in our personal training, if you will, perhaps it's ineffable, it's not overt, that says that certain people matter and certain people don't. I think of it and write about it in the book as two tiers of grief, those who matter and those who don't. And it's not a subjective matter in terms of media criticism, it's empirical. When the Media Watch Group FAIR did a study of empathetic coverage features looking at the human beings who were suffering from the Russian invasion of Ukraine, quite appropriately, there were, in a very short period of time, 14 different front page, high up empathetic stories in the New York Times about the horrible suffering that people in Ukraine were experiencing, civilians were going through because of the Russian invasion. Comparable period after the U.S. invasion of Iraq, one such story. So you have a 14 to 1 ratio. And this is where so many different biases, political, cultural, racial, come into play. And it really corrodes our own, you might say, spiritual existence, or some would think of it as ethical or political consistency, having a single standard of human rights. It's so corrosive when some people, through the messaging we get from elected officials and media, some people, we're told again and again, really matter, and some, by omission, we're told, don't matter. Just one quick example, I think, brings that home. You know, here in the Bay Area, I see so many places where I go, neighborhoods, shopping areas, I see Ukrainian flags out of support and empathy for the people of Ukraine. I haven't seen a single Yemeni flag. Why is that? There have been 400,000 people killed in Yemen with U.S. support through Saudi Arabia since 2015. We don't see any Yemeni flags, but we see Ukrainian flags. This is just an example of how we are conditioned to have empathy for some people and not others.
Mm. Well, let's hear from a caller. Let's go to Dell in Berkeley. Hi, Dell. Thanks for holding.
Hi, Rose. This is why your show is so important. This is why public radio is so important, is because of exactly what he's talking about. I mean, BBC just got caught with wrong translations. But what my point was to call in is, let's talk about where the money is going, because honestly, our taxpayer dollars are going to fund these wars. The money is going directly back into the United States because it's buying weapons from us. We are one of the biggest warmongering countries when we profit so much from wars, and we don't talk about that. I mean, how much are the elites making off of this war? And how much do they control the media? It's a cycle, you know, and this is why, Rose, you are so important.
Well, thank you so much for the call, Dell. And I'm glad you brought this up, because you reminded me of the show that we did in June about a 60 Minutes investigation. Norman, I'm curious, did you see this investigation? 60 Minutes, this is so rare. It found that weapons contractors like Lockheed Martin and Raytheon overcharge the Pentagon on almost everything the Department of Defense buys with taxpayer dollars every year. Did you see that investigation?
I've read about that report, and it's reminiscent of the notorious, you know, $600 hammer and $500 toilet seat, right, which we are told is in the past. Those overruns are very much in the present. These huge corporations are making a killing, literally and figuratively. The biggest contractors are Lockheed Martin, Boeing, General Dynamics, Raytheon, and they account for up to half of the Pentagon spending, which, by the way, since 9/11 has, this is a staggering figure, total Pentagon spending, $14 trillion with a T, dollars, mm-hmm, with almost half of that going to just a few military contractors. One other point that the caller made I think is very important. On top of all that, the U.S. is the biggest arms dealer on the planet. Almost half, upwards of 40% of all the arms exports on Earth are coming from the U.S. You know, Russia's a second way back at 16%. So we're peddling death, and it's very profitable for a few.
Also, just a couple more facts. Almost half of this year's largest ever $842 billion military budget will go to weapons contractors. And then Common Dreams, where a lot of your articles appear last month, they have a piece called War Profiteers Stocks Soar as Israel Bombs Gaza. A defense executive said at a London arms conference last month, war is good for business. The United States gives Israel $3.8 billion in annual military assistance, and President Biden asked for $17 billion more. Let's dive in and talk more about that, Norman, because you've been writing about what is happening in Israel, Gaza, and the West Bank. Given your long history of writing about U.S. foreign policy, what would you say is the United States and President Biden's foreign policy in the Middle East? And what do you think explains his unconditional support for what Israel is doing in Gaza?
The motivations are really about U.S. dominance and the alliance with Israel, which is basically part of the U.S. war machine. As you mentioned, an unprecedented 10-year deal, we're about two-thirds of the way into it, where every year hot-wired automatically $3.8 billion of the dollars in military aid goes from the United States to Israel. And then in the last few weeks, upwards of $14 billion in additional military aid immediately to be sent to Israel. Now, of course, we should condemn the terrorism that occurred on October 7th. It's absolutely horrific what Hamas did in Israel on that day. And it's absolutely horrific what Israel has been doing in Gaza on a much larger scale ever since then and continuing with this lull. And so that's certainly a decipherable through line of U.S. policy, and ethics, morality, human rights have nothing to do with it. The fist bump that President Biden gave to the de facto ruler of Saudi Arabia summer last year, Mohammed bin Salman, that's symbolic of U.S. foreign policy. I mean, talk about the rights of women. In Saudi Arabia, the policy towards girls and women, reprehensible. The repression, the torture going on in Saudi Arabia, in Egypt, another U.S. ally. We're giving huge amounts of money. We're selling arms to countries in the Middle East that are torturing their own citizens. So these are independent variables, the human rights records of a regime and U.S. support for that government. And Israel is, as the Jewish Israeli human rights organization B'Tselem has documented again and again, as Human Rights Watch, as Amnesty International, all have reported, Israel is an apartheid state. And the United States is funneling money, huge amounts of military aid to an apartheid state that is slaughtering children and other civilians in Gaza. This should bring us up short. Our assumptions are wish to believe that we have a government that really is caring about people.
What do you think is Israel's end game here, given that the north of Gaza has been completely obliterated? I mean, to think that more than half of the population has been displaced. People have nowhere to go. It's starting to get cold. People are still looking for food and water and just basic supplies to survive. It's just surreal to think that the bombing has stopped for a few days. A number of hostages have been released. In fact, I was just reading about, gosh, it's just so surreal to watch all of this happen, that the hostages being released, young children included in all of this. So in order for that to happen, the bombing stops. But then what? I mean, Palestinians who are in the South, some of them are going north to see if they still have a home, or some of them are watching videos to see if they still have a home, and they don't. What do you think is Israel's end game here?
Vicious and cynical would be a polite way to describe the U.S.-backed Israel policy. As you mentioned, Rose, telling the people in Gaza they should go south and then bombing the south as well is just, we want to say beyond belief, and yet it's happening as we speak. It has continued to happen in the last many weeks. I believe the end game is genocide. I hate to say that. I'm an American Jew. I understand the suffering of Jewish people over the last centuries and the Holocaust. I grew up hearing all about it. I understand that. Genocide is the policy of the Israeli government. And the U.S. government, with bipartisan support, is basically, with some dissent, behind that, saying it's okay. Of course it's prettied up. Of course there's continuous talk about a two-state solution and this and that. But as I know from visiting Israel, and people who've gone there have seen it on the ground, it's very vivid. It's a small country, and it's getting more and more large in terms of the expanse of settlers on the West Bank. I think part of the end game is simply to push away from Israel as many Palestinians as possible. If possible, push them into Egypt. If possible, push them into Lebanon or even Syria, and to gain more and more real estate, what used to be called facts on the ground. In the United States, we have a possibility to exert counter pressure, but right now the pressure from the United States is very minimal and not making much impact.
What do you think explains that? And what do you think, I mean, how long do you think Biden will support this?
Probably indefinitely, unless we can mobilize in an effective way from the grassroots. And this is true. And of course, your call has been covering this for many, many years, that whether it's domestic or foreign policy, human rights, women's rights, gay rights, the environment, all the positive changes that we can point to in retrospect were never handed down from on high. As Frederick Douglass said, power never concedes without a struggle. It never did. It never will. All the positive changes have come from the grassroots, from organizing. And if there's a glimmer of optimism that I feel and that I think is justified, it's because of the organizing, the protests that we've seen in the Bay Area and around the country and internationally, nonviolent efforts like on the bridge going into New York City a few days ago, led by Jewish Voice for Peace and If Not Now and interfaith groups and civic activist organizations. That's where the hope is.
I wanted to ask you about that because it is hard to keep up with all of the activism that is happening on the ground. So much of it is Jewish-led. There's a hunger strike that's taking place right now in front of the White House. Jewish Voice for Peace, and like you said, If Not Now, and other groups have been going to politicians' offices on an almost daily basis. They are shutting down bridges across the country. I mean, it's really incredible to watch. What do you think explains this mass support for the rights of Palestinians, especially by so many Jews and young Jews across the country and really also around the world?
It's a great question, Rose. There's a percolation that goes on. And I think of, for instance, the World Trade Organization protest in Seattle in 1999. For the mass media, it just came out of the blue. It was a result of meetings in living rooms and churches and synagogues and mosques. For decades in the U.S. and elsewhere, people were educating themselves. They were learning to organize. Very similar in terms of Palestine. For not just years, but decades, often enduring brickbats and bogus accusations of being anti-Semitic, Jews and non-Jews alike have gradually educated themselves and each other about what's at stake with human rights in Palestine. And that's come to fruition in part because the massacres, the mass murders in Gaza, subsidized by the U.S. government, implemented by Israel, have been so blatant this fall that it's energized people. It's sort of been a tremendous ripple effect, like the parable of the lily pond with the lily pads, and one lily pad and another, and then suddenly the whole lake is filled with lily pads, and there's been a catalyst. And I think that part of the motivation for leadership that has been taken, not entirely by any means, but importantly by Jewish groups, is to deflate, hopefully once and for all, the canard that challenging Zionism is anti-Semitic. It's just nonsense, but it's been implemented by the Israeli government for decades. They want to have it both ways. It's very cynical. They say Judaism and Zionism in Israel are all the same, and then Israel continues to commit all these terrible crimes and implementing apartheid, and then when we criticize the apartheid, we're told we're anti-Semitic.
You know, you're reminding me of the book, to think about Rosalind Carter, who just passed away, and Jimmy Carter, who is in hospice. He wrote a book, I'm looking for the year of this, Palestine Peace, Not Apartheid.
Yeah.
What was this? 2007, he wrote this book.
Yeah, and got a lot of brickbats for it. You know, no good deed goes unpunished. And so he took tremendous flack for that. And I think that ultimately, whether one considers it ethical, moral, human rights issue, a spiritual matter, it hardly really matters what we call it. There is an awakening, and it's about we need to galvanize the awakening into political power.
I think this is a good place to end, Norman, because in the midst of the fog of war, you write about just so beautifully, so many people are saying no to violence and war. You quoted Amber Amundsen in your book, who lost her spouse, Craig, in the Pentagon on 9/11. She said, if you choose to respond to this incomprehensible brutality by perpetuating violence against other innocent human beings, you may not do so in the name of justice for my husband. And then Judy Keene, who lost her husband, Richard, said bombing Afghanistan is just going to create more widows, more homeless, fatherless children. I mean, you have so many examples of this from people who lost loved ones on 9/11. And I think about the people who lost their families who were killed in Israel by Hamas. And so many of those families are calling for nonviolence. They don't want this to happen in their name. We're not hearing much from them. But there's a piece by Oren Zeev and Yotam Ronen just a couple days ago in The Nation. As they mourn their loved ones, these families are pleading for peace amid overwhelming calls for revenge in Israel after Hamas's assault. Relatives of victims are among the loudest advocates for a full ceasefire and a new approach with the Palestinians. So in our final minutes, Norman, can you just talk more about the importance of really raising these voices?
Those voices are so crucial. It's what are sometimes called the, you know, the better angels of our nature. It's much, I think, deeper and wider in that, where we have this capacity as human beings, individually and collectively, to transcend the pain that is part of life for so many people, and sometimes terribly so. Rose, you're reminding me of part of the poem by W.H. Auden, titled 1939, that I quote in the book. He wrote, "Those to whom evil is done do evil in return." Sometimes that's called a cycle of violence. One of the conceits of the U.S. in response to 9/11 is that we're all above that. But in fact, the U.S. response to 9/11 was exactly that. Evil was done on that date, and the United States did evil in return on a much more massive scale. At the end of my book, I quote James Baldwin, and this is pretty thematic, I think, of what we've been talking about in the last hour. Baldwin wrote, "Not everything that is faced can be changed, but nothing can be changed until it is faced."
And Norman, how would you respond to those who are listening to this and saying, this is just naive thinking?
The naive thinking is the idea that the United States is going to be able to enforce its will on the world. 4% of the planet's population, we can tell people, in effect, do as we say, not as we do. It's naive to think that what goes around won't come around. We are all human beings on this planet. We're not going to get away with enforcing our way with might makes right. It's in all of our interests to find, as Martin Luther King Jr. said, coexistence instead of co-annihilation.
Norman Solomon is a veteran media critic, columnist, and activist. He's co-founder of Roots Action and executive director of the Institute for Public Accuracy. Norman Solomon wrote his first book in 1982 called Killing Our Own, The Disaster of America's Experience with Atomic Radiation. Well, he's out with his 13th book called War Made Invisible, How America Hides the Human Toll of Its Military Machine. Norman, thank you so much for all of your important work, and thank you for joining us.
Thanks very much, Rose.
You can find more information about Norman Solomon's work at yourcallradio.org. Thanks to Arman Olia for producing today's show. Thanks to Kevin Vance for engineering our show. You can find all of our past shows at yourcallradio.org. And I hope you can join us for tomorrow's show. We will talk about the ongoing hunger crisis in this country. Thank you for joining us. I'm Rose Aguilar. It's Your Call.